What's up, everybody? Welcome back to Nuclear Barbarians. It is I, your Nuclear Barbarian, and I'm back in the saddle with John. We are here for part two of the theological origins of modernity. We've got a lot to get through. Gillespie has given us yet another rich pageant of figures from the pre-modern era who end up informing what we come to call the Enlightenment and the scientific revolution, frankly. And so we're going to do our best to render Gillespie's argument to you while considering its import, perhaps some of its absences and what it can include, because all books are limited, and hopefully why and how this can be important in your own thinking of yourself. And I think Gillespie, in this next chapter that we are looking at, called Humanism and the Apotheosis of Man, does a good job of opening with Petrarch, who, unless you're like me, or perhaps somebody who studied this more formally, or you're just inclined and have stumbled upon him, I know about Petrarch through the Petrarchan Sonnet as a literature student, but didn't know much about him other than the structure of that sonnet. And Gillespie asks what I think is a super important question, which is, if this guy is such a big deal, as Gillespie has made him out to be in previous chapters, even that we discuss in the first episode, why don't we read him today? Why hasn't his masterworks, why haven't they made it on to most course listings for this? I mean, I went to a great book school for grad school, St. John's in Santa Fe, and I don't remember Petrarch even being on the undergrad curriculum, which is a way more in-depth treatment of the Western canon. Of course, there's other stuff that isn't on there either that's important. Ficino's not on there, for example, as far as I remember. But what's the deal? And Gillespie has a pretty, I think, substantive claim, and it's that we are all basically Petrarchian without even knowing it. In the same way that Zizek says that we're all Fukuyamas now, we can't imagine a horizon beyond liberal democracy for politics in much of the West. We can't imagine a selfhood that moves beyond core things that Petrarch introduces to Western thought. So, what are some of those things? And I would say that one of them is, frankly, just the elevation of the idea of the individual, right? An emphasis on the imago Dei, in other words, man as the image of God, rather than man as sinner. Or, I mean, these things, and Gillespie is very careful with this. He insists and convincingly argues that no matter how secular some of this stuff may look to us now, these men were all committed Christians. Now, there's doctrinal disputes between all of them, theological disputes between all of them, but in their own self-conception, they were Christian. All of this was grafted on to a Christian project. So I think that there's what Petrarch is doing is he is sort of taking some of what Augustine does in the Confessions in the City of God and creating this like more reflective inner sanctum of the individual for true, authentic, intellectual, and thus spiritual experience. And that this happens away from the world of political activity and perhaps even commerce. So I think that that's really important. You may say, well, yeah, tons of people believe that. It's like, yes, Petrarch was really important in reviving that and then basically making it turn into this durable idea of how to live.
Yeah, I like Gillespie said that it was well put that individuals and their goals like have substance and matter, and that's not necessarily self-evident or like the dominating thought, but you see it in Petrarch, and then after Petrarch, it becomes more and more like as you said, it's like the water in which we now swim. Like that's just kind of the presumption you have as an individual today that on some level, like the
Be
goals,
taken for granted back then. Yeah.
like the aspirations and ideas that you form over your life are like important in some sense and on some level to your project of having a life. And you see this in a lot of philosophy too, that's modern, as this idea of like making your life into something that's a work of art or whatever that you're crafting yourself. And it all kind of owes to this original humanist synthesis you see in Petrarch of these different strains of more ancient thinking, which,
Yeah, so he's
you
trying
know.
to reconcile what does Gillespie say? Christian piety with Roman virtue under the rubric of Platonism.
Yeah, which is, you know, the special way in which, like, Plutarch and other Roman authors wrote biographical literature really creates this sense of, like, you're beholding a life, you know, a person who made choices, achieved certain greatnesses, and had certain tragic flaws. And that creates, like, almost an artistic, like, aestheticized, like, image of a life that you then are like internalizing and thinking about. And like as he said, you have Saint Augustine and you have the Confessions and this deep interiority. Like you can see how this stuff turns into like the soup that is Petrarch and like forward the soup that is us all now. And so
Yeah. No, absolutely. And so just to feel like, okay, but what is humanism? What are we even talking about here? Obviously, we're going through a bunch of different iterations of what humanism is going to be and mean over the course of this book, which tracks with certain trends in history. Gillespie has given us a definition that if anybody has read any defense of why you should pursue the classical liberal arts will recognize is basically Petrarchan humanism, which is in order to understand what it meant to be human and how human beings ought to live, you would commit yourself to these studies. Humanism thus was understood as a comprehensive system of education and training that put greater emphasis on human individuality, human dignity, and the privileged place of humans in the universe. Humanism was thus not simply a philosophy, but was a comprehensive cultural movement that included poetry, art, literature, history, and moral philosophy. That's the classical liberal arts.
and he points out that there's some more recent-ish scholarship that kind of tries to demonstrate that this comes out of what are called dictatores, which in Italy are like lay people who get a liberal-ish education, as we would understand it, for the purposes of being rhetoricians, lawyers, and notaries, and that kind of thing. And how this more or less like continued to exist in Italy in some form, while not necessarily being exactly what it was in Roman times, can be seen as like an extension of the idea of the citizen Rhetor. And how that existence of like a lay education for the foundation of this kind of person in society was like the fundamental basis of the project of humanism in terms of Petrarch's father as a dictatore. Like a lot of these people are coming out of that milieu. And that is sort of, at least today, that's argued to be like kind of fundamentally how you get people who are not really clergy who are operating in this kind of different way.
Yeah, exactly. And in Petrarch's wake, which is again a response to the difficulties that nominalism introduces about the relationship between man, God, and nature, and how contingent and how free God is, and what man's place is in that world. Just to do a little bit of a recap, right? That is a more, I would say, there is a very big departure from the scholastic realist position that had actual universals that corresponded to the language that we use to describe the world. And then that world was rationally structured by God to be the nature that we experience. So this is a world of ideal types and stuff like that. Nominalism is a world of rhetoric, and because of Petrarch, it sort of becomes, as an outgrowth of that, a world of self-making. There is no Aristotelian, capital E end for human life in that per se, but there can be a kind of fashioning of human life subject to deep personal individual inclinations and impulses. Right. So that is very important. And there's going to be a bunch of different types of humanism that come out of this that Gillespie is going to take us through, right? So we have Northern and Southern. That's basically the big divide here, right? And is that, John, is that part of the Hermetic divide, or does the Hermetic divide come before we get into Northern and Southern?
I don't know the exact timeline. I feel like the Hermetic stuff, which we can get into presently, was not that influential on the North, no matter kind of when
Yeah.
Northern humanism began. They weren't super interested in that, seemingly. But yeah, no, like, so in many ways, I think you could, without much exaggeration, Paul Marsilio Ficino, like kind of the fountain of the Renaissance in many ways. Like most of it in Italy would be nothing like it was without him. And I think that's probably
Absolutely.
hard to overstate. And this is all comes from a mission from the Byzantine Empire, the Eastern Roman Empire, to the West, with the goal of perhaps ending the schism. It didn't work out, but there was a delegation sent and they were in Italy. And while they were there, a really interesting guy from the Byzantine Empire named Gemistos Platon, or Gemistos Plato, is a part of that delegation. He is like the preeminent Platonic philosopher in the Eastern Roman Empire at this time. And he's part of a long line starting from earlier, Michael Psellos, who is an important, he like gathers together a lot of what was going to be known in the West as the Hermetic corpus, which I'll explain as in a minute. And so in Byzantium, there is like a manuscript tradition of like studying certain ancient writings, which are grouped together under that heading alongside Plato. And like whatever you have of the pre-Socratics and other Greek literature, kind of is like one body of knowledge. And that comes west with Mr. Gemistos Plato, who meets Cosimo de' Medici and has a pretty profound influence on him and brings with him a lot of Platonic and Hermetic writings, which he then leaves there. And so you have a lot of Greek writings, which it becomes Marsilio Ficino's job to translate. Ficino is, for our purposes, an important Renaissance philosopher in Italy. He had a lot of skill sets and was definitely like a Renaissance man, as you would come to know them. But for the purposes of this narrative, we'll just get into the fact that he was a really talented linguist and philosopher and translated fully the Platonic dialogues and a fair amount of other writing from Greek into Latin, and thus reintroduced for the first time in quite a long time, like the full scope of Plato's writings. For that, you had some of them still around in Latin, but like a lot of them were not available. And not only was he going to translate these, but he was also going to attempt like the synthetic work of making sense of this all and like explaining what it means. One interesting thing about Gemistos Plato, sorry, that you get from Gillespie, but which is worth knowing, is that it came out later that there was a secret book that he circulated among his friends that he basically rejected Christianity and wanted a revived Greek paganism mixed with Zoroastrianism to become the new national religion of the Byzantine Empire. And he wanted to move the capital to Mystras from Constantinople to have it be like decidedly Hellenic. Like,
Whoa, dude, that's wild.
It's completely insane for what is he's lived in. He was born in 1355, and
Whoa.
he gave like public speeches talking about how they were Hellens and how this was like their ancestry and all this stuff. So he later became known as the first modern Greek,
Wow.
for these reasons. But yeah, he's a pretty bizarre figure in terms of being a very late like pagan holdout, who had to keep that secret for basically his entire life in order to not get killed. But so that's the guy who brings all of this stuff west to Italy, and it makes such an impression on the Medicis that they commission the founding of the Platonic Academy by Ficino to like gather people to study and translate these works and to have like a new fluorescence of this thinking in the West again, which for whatever reason the Medicis are really interested in. I've never looked too much into why that is, but they bankroll and like spur this on completely. So the Hermetic Corpus, what we now know, was probably written in the first 2 centuries, Common Era, in the Near East, maybe largely around Alexandria or within that milieu. How to talk about this without talking way too much. So
I know it's so difficult, right? Because it's sort of like it's this corpus of some of it written, some of it is actually authentic Platonic dialogues, in my understanding. How about I make some statements and then you tell me if I'm right or wrong? And that's how we'll get through this. So some of it's Plato and then some of it was written after. The way it's received by the Hermetics is if it is all Plato, which colors their ideas of how they can blend a Neoplatonism with some of the postnominalist ideas of Christianity that they've inherited, which is the slurry that becomes Renaissance humanism.
okay, so I can offer some correction there that does
Hell
make
yeah.
clear. So the Hermetic Corpus is, in like a traditional sense, attributed to Hermes Trismegistus, who is thought to be either a sage or like the Greek god or some mixture thereof, of Hermes, who is also in the tradition of Interpretatio Graeca, which is like the Greeks just looking at other people's pantheon and saying, oh, that's our pantheon. So Hermes is very quickly associated with Thoth in Egypt. And so they basically have temples to both of them at the same time. And this person is, again, either seen as a sage or a god or both, who imparted great wisdom in very ancient, distant times. So these are purported to be teachings of Hermes. And I think the thing that maybe I don't want to explain for too long, but definitely do need to explain, is that like the way this was understood in antiquity, for sure in late antiquity, like, well, once we get into the first and second centuries, we'll say, of our era, it is pretty much the normative view that wisdom is essentially proceeding out of like one fount, like from God to man, and that everything has genealogical connections to each other. So people will commonly claim like Plato was learning from Pythagoras, and Pythagoras was taught by Hermes. Like you have these constructions of genealogies like laid out already, and that's just kind of the way people are looking at it. They make connections to Egyptian sages, to Persian sages, to Indian sages. And this sort of idea that like people are receiving divine wisdom, and then that either filtered down through a genealogy of teaching to Plato and Aristotle and others, or Plato and Aristotle and others received some teaching but also had direct divine inspiration themselves, and that this is how they were able to basically evince the truth. And I think what maybe is important to understand is that this is how people are thinking because this is the way in which they largely understand truth. Like the literate, syncretistic thinkers of the Near East of antiquity basically understand truth as something which, if it's true, then that means it has always existed because truth is eternal. And the old The newer something is, the less likely it is to matter at all. Like,
Hardcore Lindy effect, guys, basically,
yeah.
right? Like they're taking that as far as you possibly can. I should also say that, like, I want to make that, not that you made it sound ridiculous, but I could see how somebody would respond to that as being like, come on now. And just the simple question to keep in the back of your mind whenever you hear something like that is, do we create the capital T truth of math? Or do we discover an inherent universal truth through axiomatic thinking? And by the way, the how you answer that question really informs how you see the rest of the world.
And this isn't to.
They're discover guys. You're discovering maybe something that is true about the world. And the older that it is, and the more consensus there is about it across cultures, milieus, whatever, the more likely it is to have been true forever, to, in other words, be their version of truth, like you said.
I think that's a good way of putting it. And one of the things that like Christianity comes about in this world, and the first and like one of the greatest Christian apologists is a guy named Justin Martyr, who's born around 100 AD. And from the writings of Justin Martyr onwards, you see Christians engaging this milieu on its own terms, because they are basically of it. So they need to find a way to justify Christianity in terms of this way of thinking, because they're trying to do apologetics, which means like, this is why you should be a Christian. But why should you be a Christian if it's brand new? Like, that makes no sense. Like, how could you possibly have access to truth? And so they start developing as well. Like, and this predates Christians. Like, the Jews were already saying that Moses was a part of this nexus, and that Moses like taught Hermes, and then you know what I mean, like that's already happening right now. And so Christians basically just have to pick up this Jewish line with Moses, which they find very useful, and then do some interesting theological work as to how Christianity is like reviving the perfect ancient religion or whatever. So you already have a fully realized like discourse about the ancient theology, the Prisca Theologia, which is something that Ficino brings up a lot, or like the perennial wisdom, or all of these things. This is just like kind of the going discourse already. This is the currency in which you must trade in order to be understood in this world, where philosophy is also very religious and also has ritual components, and it's very difficult to pull those apart from each other. It is a tendency in which the modern interlocutor is very embarrassed, I think, about this and tries to like overlook a lot of it, but it kind of denudes what's really going on and renders it sort of difficult to understand.
It's like trying to get the alchemy out of Newton,
Yeah,
where you're like,
like.
no, he wasn't doing any of that weird gold shit. We're doing strictly scientific rationality here. And it's like, well,
This is, as we just discussed, going to be the topic of the next book we're going to read. So I will not belabor the point too much, but just to help you understand what's going on here with Ficino. And I think, you know, like Saint Augustine himself sort of even brings this up, where he says the Christian religion is what we now call the true religion, but the true religion has existed since Adam. And like it has always been available in some form or another. And like Justin Martyr said that the Logos has existed forever. And so that means that if you participated in the Logos, even if you didn't know it, you were always a Christian, even before Christianity. Like people are already trying to develop this idea that Christianity is a part of this universal wisdom tradition that allows for salvation, and that like has been delivered unto mankind. And so Marsilio Ficino is in a world where some amount of this thinking has gone more forgotten, probably because the manuscript tradition for some of these earlier apologists was not necessarily available as much to these people. However, these people had huge effects on great church fathers like Origen and those guys who were more available. So there are still the remnants of this thinking, but Ficino gets like the source texts again. He gets the Platonic dialogues, he gets parts of the Hermetic corpus. And he's able to engage in a lot of the same kind of thinking, but he now has kind of a new world in which he's doing. Like the context has changed. Like we said, the nominalist revolution has called into question the relationship of God and creation and the nature of, rationality versus the structure of things. And Petrarch has inaugurated a new way of thinking about the human being as an individual and the importance and meaning of that. And I think what we are now looking at, and we're going to look at more in the Luther chapter, is the Catholic Church is in an extremely dire state, of like Luther's visit to Rome seemed horrifying, of like wickedness, sin, and like death.
Atheism.
Yeah, the atheism, like, it shocked him and would probably shock even some of us today. But it seems that things are not like well in Rome. There's the controversy with the indulgences and the fact that some people might feel that paying for salvation has gone a little too far when the funds that are being paid for salvation are going directly into the Sistine Chapel. And like, one wonders what the point of all of this is and like if it's really godly anymore. And kind of like happening amid all of that, but predating some of that a little bit, is basically having all of this Platonic material that people were interested in, like Petrarch, who, was an admirer of Augustine, who was definitely a Platonist. And now you have this all, and you can begin to do the philosophical work of trying to explicate exactly like what this all means, like, what is the metaphysical nature of reality? What is the relationship of that metaphysical nature to like the imparting of this wisdom to human beings? How has that happened? How are we supposed to understand these things? And doing it all within a still Catholic context. And Ficino himself is going to go through stages where he's interested in magic and then sort of rejects it as not Christian later in his life, but still maintains the importance of this wisdom tradition. But this is kind of like the reinjection of a strain of thinking into the Western world, which is going to have like very profound effects from here on out in a very subdued and like subterranean way, we'll say, like in terms of it's not what you'll read in like an intellectual history, like highlighted so much, but it's there from here on out as, a form of philosophical thought and a form of understanding like history and religion and like the way that those things are laid out across time, I'll say.
Yeah, so I just want to highlight some parts of that because I think all of that's very important. But again, what's important here is that people are trying to figure out how to answer a very simple and vexing question, which is, how am I to live? And that question gets answered in the context that John has just laid out very artfully for us here. And that's what they're trying to do. Now, if you consider the discursive habits of this sort of, these things have been true for all time, that's happening in early Christian apologetics, that we get reinjected into the Renaissance era along with Platonism and the Hermetic tradition, etc. What you see is people are looking at Rome, which has changed so much since the days of the early church, which means that it is patterning people's social experience of their relationship to the Christ that they believe in. And they're saying, not how do I build something new, but how do I return to something more authentic? The southern strand of humanism is going to rely on the ancient thinkers who participate in this substrate of true things, transcendentally true for all time, even if not fully Christian, to try and answer that question. And it's not like they do it without anxieties. We can see those anxieties in the work of Dante, for instance, who puts, is it Plato or Socrates he puts in limbo? I can't remember which he highlights.
Properties.
Socrates, yeah, right, because he's the more Christ-like figure, because he allows for his own death, right? That's one reading of it, provided you never read Xenophon. That's a debate for another time. But anyway, You can see that because he can't place him in heaven, but he doesn't want to totally cast away the ancients. And also, Virgil is his guide through hell, right? Already we see that synthesis happening here. Now, the discussion in the north is going to be very, very different from this. And it is going to be basically hostile to the idea that you can borrow from these pagans, right? Because we have to consider that all of these thinkers that Ficino's dealing with, that Machiavelli's dealing with when he has his own, a little, frankly, a little bit more secular, civic, republican humanism, right? All of that is more native for a longer period of time in that Mediterranean milieu. That's not true when you go north of the Alps. Very, very different up there. And I think that really patterns their response to this, their response to humanism, which is they're in the wake of the nominalist revolution, but their response is way more. I want to say this phrase without sort of the modern or contemporary, I should say, a meaning, which is they are like biblical fundamentalists in a very, very different way. They don't want to borrow from Cicero. They don't want to borrow from Plato. They think that that is a pagan subversion. And apparently, as John talked about us talked to us before about some of these guys who were in the eastern part of the Byzantine Empire or Byzantine Empire, it is actually true.
Yeah, like it's probably worth thinking about that the guy who brought Plato to the West did want to destroy the Christian church.
Yeah.
Like, literally.
So
Religion.
they weren't paranoid, right? Well, okay, let me put it this way. Even if they were paranoid, right, this is like the Lacanian thing where a patient comes to Lacan and he's paranoid that his wife is cheating on him, and then one day he brings Lacan, the psychoanalyst, the French psychoanalyst, evidence of this, and Lacan says that doesn't really matter because your pathology is still paranoid. Like, the problem isn't whether or not she is cheating on you, it's your response to that that's the problem.
Yeah, and I think too, one thing worth noting is that the people in the North, like the educated people in the North, had for a long time and were still familiar with classical authors and even enjoyed them. And like Luther himself
Totally.
read and like Virgil and a few other people, but the way in which they incorporate those authors into their lives and into their understandings of Christianity is extremely different from the way it's happening in the South. Like, they still read and find value and beauty in these things, but it's much more. So there's an earlier letter from one of the popes, and I can't remember his name now, but he writes a letter on the proper uses of Greek poetry for the Christian student. And it basically gives you carte blanche to read Greek literature with the caveat that you develop an understanding that parts of it are conducive to Christian virtue and you should learn from it, and parts of it are harmful to you as a Christian and you should protect yourself from it. So if you read in this semi-appreciative, semi-guarded way, then Greek literature like Homer and so on can all be very like useful and good for you, and like you can appreciate it. Like in a sort of almost like this is secular, but I can look at it way. And I think that that kind of spirit is sort of what you see in the North in terms of they have it, they like it, but they don't let it get too close to like theology and things of that nature, which is reserved for like we are learning from the revelation and like reason on some level, like a mixture of these two things. And we're not really admitting the authority of like philosophic tradition.
Yeah, exactly. It's interesting, perhaps productive, but non-authoritative. And the attempt to make it authoritative, to put it on the same level as scripture, is dangerous. It's subversive and dangerous. And so if you're a guy like Luther, you're seeing a few different things happening at the same time. You're seeing this happen. You're also seeing what's happening politically and culturally within the church, which, again, as we say, when he goes to Rome, he's like, what the What is going on here, everybody? This is crazy. Some of these people don't, a lot of these people don't even believe in God. There is just like naked corruption with the elites. I'm sure, you know, importantly, Luther wasn't a Calvinist, though I am sure the level of carnality that was on display was shocking to him. If historical reports from that era, contemporaneous reports are correct. So this creates a different response to the Renaissance humanist patriarchy and Ficino rubric, which is, by the way, also really centered in art as an experience. So visuals, visual creation, because that is how, by basically like the phenomenology of aesthetics, you can approach the divine, because it is operating on some of the same nominalist principles that you could only approach the divine through metaphor. Art becomes very, very important for that and the cultivation of the individual. This is going to be less true for Northern, eventually Protestants. It's going to be very different for them and how they receive the idea of the image. And there is also an idea, a syncretism of Platonic love as spelled out in Plato's Symposium, as a viable kind of Christian love. And that also, if you read Ficino, and I've read a little bit of him through Peter Sloterdijk, if you read it, it's very weird. They didn't know how the circulatory system worked yet. And so they have these strange ideas that when you fall in love with somebody, the reason you blush is because your blood is rising up through your cheeks to literally leave your body to intermingle with their blood as they're blushing, and that creates this like bond between people, right? The bond of the beautiful, you know? So totally wild stuff like that features massively in how these guys thought about this stuff in their time.
Yeah, like I feel like if you think about the painting of the Academy, is that what it's called? With like all
Yeah.
of these guys, and you can see like that's a really good image in a lot of ways to try and understand this, like what's going on here, and the way in which philosophy is like very influential on this new style of art that's just proliferating. Tons of money is getting thrown at all these guys who you've heard of, you know them well. They're all out here. They're making statues of David. They're painting chapels and all kinds of stuff. This is all like coming in a large way out of this Petrarchian like inheritance and this reinjection of various kinds of middle and late Platonic thought into this world of very new problems. And like it's important to understand, I think, the ways in which these all inform each other, or at least be aware that that's happening. Even though we can't spend a lot of time dwelling on it, it's going to be pretty foundational for like all to come aesthetic thinking, which is really going to like balloon from a niche field that almost no one wrote about to like something that everyone is considering all the time in a few hundred years.
Yeah, I mean, I think the road from this to like Schiller and some of the romantics is direct, you know, like this is the freeway to get to that off ramp, you know. That's how this ends up working. Not that it's predetermined, of course, I'm not. Don't take that metaphor too far in terms of history. Okay, so one last thing I want to say about some of these guys, including Erasmus, who has his own ideas about this. I believe he's a Southern guy.
Erasmus is part of the
Oh, was he Northern?
northerly
Okay.
mind, yeah.
So one of the things that I want to say about this will be a good way to talk about it, is that for the most part, both the Northern and the Southern guys were not interested in creating another church. They saw themselves as subjects of the Catholic Church that needed reform. Sometimes it was deep moral reform, right? Not necessarily even institutional reform. The problem was the people in the institutions and how they thought about things, how they felt about things. And that this, as part of a humanist response, that is why the idea of being inculcated in these ideas, the education of the humanist education, is so vital to all of them in their own way.
Yeah, the tensions within the church had kind of been building in a way for a long time between the papacy and the curia and this very, I'll say, ornate and like wealthy side of things. And it had its beginnings in the early Middle Ages, where you have gold going to monasteries and being used to adorn artifacts and things, and essentially wealth is being used to kind of show like the glories of God in the next world, and like it's meant to have an inspirational effect. So there's some justification for like taking in this wealth and using it to make beautiful things that are then housed in the churches. But we see that like times 10,000, and you end up getting people who are involved in the clergy who are very wealthy, who don't seem to be living by Christian principles. They're taking mistresses, they have tons of money. In some cases in Germany, they have tons of political power directly. You have duke bishops and things like that. So there's that
Which
side
you
of
got to
it.
read, like the Protestant revenge novel, like the first quote unquote Western, which is Michael Kohlhaas, and you get like a pretty good feeling how this works. Martin Luther, by the way, is a character in that novel. There's a 2015 film version of it starring Mads Mikkelsen, which is sort of like a brilliant casting job.
That sounds amazing. But so you get that, and then you get the church having over time, like consistently, movements that try to have something more like poverty centric, I'll call it, just to, have a way of designating it, of rejection of this world and of wealth and of these kinds of things for what they think is a more like genuine Christian life patterned on the Gospels. And this is the
I
Franciscans,
was about to say from last episode, that's the Franciscan response, yeah.
and this is basically, so the philosophical debates are also tied up in debates about what the church should be like and what its role in human life should be and how these people who are its representatives should be living. And this is something where you get an eventual sort of ceasefire between the Franciscans and the church, but the problem doesn't go away. And it's a problem that predated that, and it is continuing to exist, and it comes to a head in the lifetime of Martin Luther in a
Yeah.
pretty dramatic way.
Who I think we can move on to, because we'll touch on Erasmus and Luther even further in the next episode. So I actually don't want to spend too much more time on hashing out the North and South divide that we already have. So, man, I have to say, just from reading this chapter, John and I were talking about this before we recorded. He sent me a very funny and very sad text about it. Is that if you know anything about the history of the Reformation and how insane and violent it was in many of its twists and turns, reading this chapter on Luther and his ideas, and you can see how his my ideas were misappropriated by hardcore zealots, armed zealots. To do what they did to create, as John described them, Warhammer 40K style death squads in Northern Europe. It was just really sad. And also because I think the thing that we as moderns, perhaps even more so as postmoderns at this point, can have in common, or that to tell on myself, I feel I have very much in common with Luther, is his nagging, overwhelming sense of doubt and skepticism that the entire architecture of his metaphysics is built around. So he takes the nominalist challenge to the hilt, and he wants to, but he wants to figure out how to get almost a more apodictic certainty of the relationship between man and God, to recover that somehow. Whether he succeeds in that is, again, the open question, and also ties into how he thought the church ought to be governed, especially after his visit to Rome and things he saw going on in Northern Europe, so on and so forth, that we've already touched on. But this chapter just made me profoundly sad. And it's not even written in a sad way. I was just my response to it internally was very sad.
Yeah, you can see that he was clearly a sincere person in an extremely difficult and corrupt time for somebody who wants to be a committed Christian, who lives in a world in which Christianity means being a part of the church, which has a this worldly structure, which appears to have been tainted very severely by things that are just undebatably unchristian. Like, there's really no way to say that it was okay. Like, if you are like, everyone was wrestling with this because it was very blatant. And like, just as there is, we know, a Reformation, there's also attempts at reform that are, happening within the church that don't end up leaving the church. Like, everyone recognizes that things were getting really bad, and what to do about it wasn't entirely clear. And Luther has a response to a very personal theological issue of faith, which is just that every time he meditated on sort of like the awesome power of God, it was very difficult for him to understand like how he could be okay. Like, against that, what can you do? How can you even have faith that you won't be destroyed? Like, it's very difficult. And it seems that he was very disquieted by this for a very long time, to the point where he was even forbidden from contemplating God's wrath by his superior in monastery.
Which is really funny. He was just like, you need to stop thinking about that and think more about God's forgiveness because you're annoying right now.
And he was like, okay, but not actually.
Yeah. But what if that was a what if that was a stalking horse for also thinking about God's wrath?
But so Luther, over the course of his life, then comes to interpret the divine justice and like the divine judgments in a certain passage of the Bible, which I don't have in front of me, but not as in God's judgment of mankind, but as in God's grace of vindicating mankind. He just sort of, it's something where you read the words and you're like, the interpretation of this is like, it could be pretty open. And he, through reading it, I think a lot, just sort of comes to looking at it a different way. And that's where you get kind of the fundamental tenet of like a lot of Protestantism, which is that you are saved by faith alone. Faith is given through grace from God to you. Like, you don't get faith on your own. It comes to you from God, and the medium is the scripture. So like, by exposing yourself to the scripture, you can become a recipient of this grace from God, which then allows you to be saved, because you are sinful. You can never become like good. You are just saved, but you are not good. And that's kind of like fundamentally what Luther comes to as a way of resolving this crisis that is very, for him, personal, but it's also tied up in the context in which he lives, in the decadence in which is all around him, and becomes part of a greater project of his theses, which are then published, which lay out a lot of his problems with the current goings on. And which, when he published them, it was his sincere hope that he would get a response from the papacy, which would be like willing to have a dialogue with him to maybe do reforms, because his desire was for the church to remain the church, the Catholic Church that everyone is a part of, but to become something which like was able to purge itself of the immense corruption that was existing at the time. That
It
is not.
reminds me of in the lead up to the American Revolution, the War for Independence, there is a common feeling among the founding fathers and many other Americans, that if only they could figure out how to make their case plainly and clearly to King George without the interference of Parliament, that he would understand what Parliament was doing to them and set things right.
Which is really fascinating. Not
Yeah.
to go on a tangent,
Yeah,
but
it's a very fascinating element in the American Revolution. It takes a long time until they think he's being misled by Parliament, that he wouldn't do this to his subjects, right? That he's being interfered with. Again, there comes a point where they're basically like, I mean, except for guys like Jefferson, who I don't think ever entertained that idea. It takes a while for them to be disabused of the case, and that the same is true for Luther. It is not until it's clear that the church, as he sees it, is not amenable to the things that he sees and is also hostile to him, that he sort of realizes he might have to go his own way.
And even at that point, he doesn't break with the idea of a Catholic church and the not as a proper noun, but as in like a universal church of all Christians. He simply thinks that the Catholic Church, the proper noun version, is basically in the thrall of the devil, who is in fact, and this is another interesting part of Luther's kind of worldview, which is that the
Yeah,
devil is
very fascinating. We should dwell on his idea of Satan.
yeah, like in contrast to his teacher mentor's idea, where Satan's activity in the world is constrained by God, whose overwhelming grace and mercy kind of like delimits that. For Luther, Satan is kind of let loose upon the world, and this is the result of that, is that people are falling under the sway of satanic misguidance and being led into what is going on today. And that this is a sign of the fact that we're in the end times, and the fact that once things really get going and the break with the church is complete, then I think you get even more the feeling that this is happening because we are in the last days. Like, this is why the truth is being revived now, and it's breaking out of the church, which has been corrupted, is because we're preparing for like the eschaton is about to just like happen. Which, you know, millenarianism is not like in any way new, we'll say, for anyone who's not like familiar with Christianity. Like, basically, since the beginning, people were ready for the end and like thought it was coming soon. And this is a part of like a much longer tradition of that. But the way in which it's happening and the world in which it's happening are pretty different from antiquity in a lot of ways.
And I just want to add something here. I want to tease out. So we were talking about what separates the northern response from the southern response. And I actually think that one of the best ways to illuminate this is to look at Luther's idea of the devil and how the devil brings people into sin, right? Which he says, the devil, this is Gillespie, the devil, Luther believed, is the ruler of this world. He rules men not by force, however, but by guile, in a quasi-Machiavellian fashion, appealing to their pride, their desire for fame, their reason, and even their concern for their fellow man. Luther's devil, in contrast to the devil of his predecessors, is not the corporeality that weighs down an eternal soul and subverts divine and human reason. It is rather a wrongly directed will that aims not at God, but at its own self-interest. If you take that seriously, it is impossible to turn the pagan philosophers of antiquity into things on an equal plane with scripture as an authority for how to live your life. Because there is no way to read Aristotle's Ethics or Politics and not understand the import of things like self-interest and fame in how to live the good life. Those are not things to be embarrassed of. They're just things to be done rightly in the Greek and Roman worlds. This is anathema. This is falling into the hands of the devil to Luther. So here you see how he has also created a conception of evil that seems to encompass all of the things that have encircled what he sees as the truth of the church. And has captured it in its enemy's hands, which is the devil's hands. I think that to me is a very, very important difference here.
What was fascinating about that particular segment was that it's pretty close, I would say, to like an Islamic idea of the devil, in that the devil is all about essentially guile and like suggestion, I think. There's a pretty common, like, one of the fundamental ideas is whisperings, what they call it. Waswasas, and like these whisperings come to you from the devil or like demonic minions or whatever. And They will attempt to like lead you down a bad path through subverting you through all of these different means. And the way in which you resist those things is sort of like reliance on God, trust in God, and being directed towards like God in a certain way and like receiving protection from that. Although they do say that like either your own self is like worse than like 10 or 100 devils, like your own ego and like lower self in the ancient construction. So the exact nature of what is the devil and what is yourself and how that psychologically plays out in Islam is a little ambiguous. And I think like that's just like kind of a comfortability with the ambiguity is there, but it's also much more moderated than Luther's version, and I don't think any like Muslim theologian would claim that the devil rules this world, but like the devil is laying there waiting to snare everyone walking through this world.
Yeah,
Yes.
absolutely. I think there's
I
a
just found it
more.
kind of fascinating that there was a lot of resonance there nonetheless with these kind of ideas. And it's something that I have seen a lot in reading this book, which is things that you might find to be new in a Western context existed for some time in the Islamic world, just philosophical conceptions or theological conceptions. And people are now attempting to do some work of like laying out possible lines of communication and ways in which things were transmitted. And I think that'll be an interesting field going forward because now people are trying to pay attention to the way in which it's a lot better to talk about the West as inclusive of the Islamic Mediterranean as one more operative unit of history in which things were going back and forth, and they were far more informative to one another than previously people like to have thought. And it's definitely something that you encounter a lot doing this kind of investigation of the more porous borders of thinking. Much the same way that the people are now kind of more open to the very ancient idea, like we just talked about, that Greek philosophy probably had a lot to do with non-Greek things going back and forth in a kind of interchange.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's no, I think that's true. I think what's unique about Luther is the fever pitch at which he operates. He seems to be
Definitely agreed.
a man of extremes in some ways. I want to talk about three things here that I'm just going to lay out real briefly. And two are things that I think are very politically important about what Luther's doing. And then I want to talk about what makes him like, the Teutonic response versus the Anglo response to some of these ideas, which Gillespie touches on, that I think is also very, very important, especially for those of us who are Americans that are basically Anglo in like cast of mind, almost no matter what. It's kind of crazy how culture can be that powerful. So at least two things are very, very important about Luther's maneuver here, right? So by faith alone, are you redeemed? Faith isn't really something you do, but something God puts in you, and then you dwell in him. That feels a little ambiguous to me. By the way, if we have anybody who's like a very serious Lutheran or a former serious Lutheran or something like that, or let us know about that, because I think towards the end here, we're going to talk about some weaknesses in Luther's thought that we thought we had after reading Gillespie. So we'd love to hear from you about what we get right or wrong on this, and maybe we'll talk about it a little bit next episode. So comment on the Substack or send me an email, emmett@nuclearbarbarians.com. That's EMMET at nuclearbarbarians.com. And John and I will try to do our best to be faithful and responsive. So faith alone is an incredibly more, I would say, democratic idea, or at least suggests that. It undermines the hierarchical aspects of the Catholic Church, the need for certain elements of priesthood hierarchy and bureaucracy and stuff like that. It's also dependent on the idea that you can read scripture. So, having a translation of the Bible in your language or just having access to the text is very important. That's not something people had outside of priests within the church, right? So the Gutenberg press, all of this stuff are heavily important for this to be viable, right? It almost needs material conditions that coincide that allow for this to be a plausible way forward, right? So that's part of it. I think that is, it already starts to create a deviation between secular political power and private religious power. And that holds even true for how Luther sees the role of princes and how people should serve them up to a certain point, but that the prince can never compel you to believe something other than what is true through scripture. So we already see a distinction that's going to become incredibly important in modernity, in the dawn of the Enlightenment. And this is the secular domain versus the religious domain. These things were entirely integrated in the era predating Luther. Then I also want to bring up something that is very, very important, especially within the American tradition of politics, which is antinomianism. And it is the idea that you are beholden to laws that are beyond because of this rupture between the secular and the divine and how politics plays out with that, that you there are laws higher than the ones of the state, than the nomos, the laws of the state, that those things aren't one and the same, right? The laws of the state are not the laws of God and vice versa necessarily. Luther's going to argue that that isn't true. And we see that play out in the American context all the time, for better and for worse, right? So it's no surprise that Martin Luther King Jr. relies on plenty of antinomian arguments to get rid of segregation, as he well should. We see this also in men like Emerson and Thoreau and the American Transcendental tradition and some of their ideas on abolition and things like that. And we see it all the time. We see it now, even in, and I've critiqued this in the movie How to Blow Up a Pipeline, the climate discourse, where rather than religion or something like that, you have this scientistic idea of what science can tell you that creates the law beyond the world that you live in that you must adhere to ensure your own survival. Right. So we see different permutations of it, but that is an indelibly important part of the modern move. John, I don't know if you want to respond to any of that before we hop on to some of our questions about Luther.
Just that you can find a lot of the raw materials of that in pretty much the whole span of medieval political thought, where they initially have these fledgling kingdoms being carved out of the former Western Roman Empire, and they need some kind of law. So they start developing these law codes that are somewhat inheritances of the Roman law codes that they already had. And eventually, you get people getting a hold of Justinian's code and adapting that. And you also have people adapting their old, like, unwritten barbarian laws and then putting them in. And you get in this milieu, Christian thinkers articulating the idea of natural law versus this instantiated law and the idea that they could differ, because it's always a thing in Christianity that, like, you have temporal authorities, but you also like have superseding all of that, this
Yeah,
duty.
city of God, city of man type thing. Yeah.
Exactly. So, and City of God was a foundational book for the early Middle Ages, and whether or not people were that familiar with it later, pretty much every person read at least some of it in those days. And it was kind of a big thing that people were thinking about when they were setting up, like Charlemagne, these large temporal authorities, like which were very divinely justified. Like a lot of Charlemagne's legislation was about making people Christian in the proper way, getting rid of pagan rituals, and standardizing the rites according to the Roman model. Like, without Charlemagne, there would be no Roman Catholic Church as you know it, because he made the very disparately practicing churches of the West into essentially one thing through his power as somebody who took control of most of the Western world and was able to like hand out these things and have like an A team of clerics slash scholars who were kind of putting this into practice. But so this tension is always there and kind of available. Like this idea that you have two
Absolutely.
laws to respond to. And I think that when you look in a little bit later, when we get into the Enlightenment, that's when this is actually going to be directly used by people like Montesquieu and so on when they start considering these things and like the Jeffersonian idea of, like when is it proper to rebel, which isn't unique to Jefferson, but you know what I mean? Like,
Yeah, that's our most direct inheritance. So I should say, I should temper my point about Luther a little bit and say it's not that he's inventing this distinction, it's that he is firming it in a way where it was more porous before, and that is a very important shift in how it goes. And I'm glad that you brought up Charlemagne and stuff like that, because I realized I forgot to mention my Anglo versus Teutonic point here. I'm being a little bit facetious, right, when I'm saying this. I don't want to make some like weird blood and soil argument or something like that. But it's a cultural difference to notice that creates theological differences. And the reason that it made me think of that is because we see these debates happen again in the English Reformation between the hotter kind of Protestant, right? So the Puritan and the more, I would say, like pragmatic for its time, like certain Anglican elements of it and how that plays out. And it's that the Calvinist influence in the West is way more abhorring of the body and the corporeality of the world, the materiality of the world. And Luther does not share that with Calvin at all. Sex was vitally important to him because human procreation and the love between man and woman was basically an emblem of God's power over Satan, in a way, and that God was with you even when you were taking a dump, which he actually said, and is to him a hugely important thing to say. You can only imagine how wretched bathrooms were back then, and they were actually seen as like Satan's hangout spot because they were so wretched and filthy. So him saying that is actually, I think, a very beautiful and hopeful insistence for all of his millenarianism of God's nearness to you in all of your life, potentially. Now, this is where we can talk to some of the problems that we're going to see here that I think are going to be featured in the debate between Erasmus and Luther in the next chapter of Gillespie's book. One of the big issues here, I would say to me, two of them are the nature of faith and the nature of the word. So how faith works brings up very big, important questions that weren't resolved in this, and I think Gillespie would say aren't resolved by Luther, but the nature of human will and how that works. If you're chosen to be faithful, why you would need to receive the word at all to be brought into it, because Luther does believe that speaking the word of God is one of the most important things. This is why sermons are still important, singing is vitally important, all of these things. So that's at least not clear to me. And Gillespie intimates that this is a soft spot in Luther's thinking himself. This is why I would love for some Lutherans, if there are any listening, to give us some feedback on this. And then the nature of the word itself, I think this is a problem that we see not just with Protestantism, but throughout. And it is basically, what kind of text is scripture? And what kind of reading is interpretive versus being revealed the truth? How do those things work? There seems to be big ambiguity in Lutheran about how this works. The Bible is both a supreme metaphor for God, but also has this ability to create the faithful who are then also chosen by God. You can kind of see here how there's a lot of difficulties being worked through or attempted at that are spillover effects from the nominalist revolution. That's my thinking on this. John, where are you?
Yeah, one thing we forgot to mention, but is really important, is that humanism is also basically the birth of philology, which
Oh,
is
yeah. So glad you brought
essentially
that up.
like change everything. And one of the things you get is he mentions it in the book, but you get people like Ficino was definitely a great linguist. You had others, I think Pico di Mirandola was like trained by a Jewish scholar in Arabic. So he probably even had access directly to some Arabic texts that he was studying, as well as Greek and other things. You get people starting to get a knowledge of the language in which the original like biblical writings were in. So you have people reading Koine Greek and people studying Hebrew in the Old Testament and things like that, and starting to do like biblical philological studies of like these texts, and no longer relying on the Latin translation that you had
Yes.
from St. Jerome or whoever it was who did the first big one. But people are now trying to look directly at the Bible, but people are also doing textual criticism just in general. Like, I think it's a little later. You have Isaac Casaubon, who is the person who proves that the Hermetic corpus is not as old as it claims, philologically.
Yes. I think that's true, yeah.
You have before him, and here there's the proving that the Donation of Constantine is a forgery using philological methods, which, by the way, like it's kind of worth reading. So the Donation of Constantine was a document that was found, I'm pretty sure, I want to say in the 900s, in the earlier days of the church, when the power of the papacy did not really extend beyond the borders of the city of Rome in terms of authority. This document kind of shows up and is like, hey, Constantine basically ceded all temporal authority to like the Pope. It's kind of crazy, but true.
Yeah,
Like,
big if true, yeah.
Pope to be like the emperor of the West, basically. And
Yeah.
this was sort of like held to be valid for a long time and used to justify papal authority. It was now proved to have been forged by probably some guy in a monastery somewhere, like under orders, who knows. But so people are using the study of language and the study of words and like grammar and so on to like look critically at texts and be able to say, like, what can we say about this text? And one thing is dating them, like via the terms that they use and the way in which they write. When is it possible that this could have been written, like at least within a high probabilistic sense? And you're getting that. That's kind of the background for Luther wanting to look directly at the Bible with this humanistic lens of like philologically trying to understand what the Bible is saying, and this sort of being the means by which you can read and obtain meaning. Because like you said, there's a lot of, for me, ambiguity in an uncomfortable way, and this idea that I'm going to read and receive meaning. And it's
Like
sort of in an inspired
unmediated
way.
almost. Like that's the
Yeah,
strange
but at
thing.
the same time, Luther is critical of personal interpretation and of mystical revelation, and he thinks that that is like a path to error. And I think he's probably right about that. And a lot of it is. Like without a structure around that that can define it and give it a proper scope, it can do anything it wants because you're like, well, that's what I thought or heard or felt. And I think that that's something that you should be wary of when you're doing this. But at the same time, I guess what I'm seeing is that he clearly understands that these are problems, but he doesn't seem to have any good way of preventing them from within his own philosophical thinking about this stuff. Like, there doesn't seem to be any clear safeguard against that, even if he understands that it's a problem. And that, to me, like having not read the works of Luther in any depth at all, like seems to be one of the reasons why what happens next is sort of, and I won't pretend to say that if he had formulated this in a different way, that the Reformation just wouldn't have happened like it did. Like, I don't think that that's how it was. Or that really relied that closely. To my understanding, Luther, his break is kind of like a watershed moment, but how inspired people are by him, I think, differs person to person. And
And also what's happening with other breaks for similar reasons and other, again, the Anglo, the English experience of this is different in a lot of ways, and there's also the Dutch experience of it, right? So this is happening all at the same time. There's also the opening of the New World. I think I've talked about this when we were talking about Machine in the Garden, but the experience of the Arctic as an entirely, like literally a tabula rasa, opened up phenomenologically and experientially all sorts of questions about the nature of representation while we're doing all this, repositioning around the nature of rhetoric, metaphor, and the approach to the divine. So this isn't monocausal. There's a lot going on. Luther is incredibly important. It's also clear that he was not the murderous radical that some of his alleged, I would say, descendants theologically ended up being, and that he w went to his grave pointing out how they had fallen into under the sway of Satan.
Yeah, he was generally against like violent political activism, which started happening in his lifetime. He continued to maintain that that was wrong. Not that he was like blindly supporting whatever political authority existed, but simply that given the current conditions, like contributing to chaos and violence was like not what you should be doing. And so long as like the prince was ruling justly enough that you were able to practice your faith, like then that's fine, you know? And so people who are kind of like, we're going to create a new community and kill literally everyone who disagrees, they're pretty troubling to him. And Gillespie points out something that I've heard elsewhere too, which is that after the Theses, Luther was not really considered that important by anyone in terms of his overall influence. And the writings that he contributed after the Theses really like mattered to his direct followers and the people who would follow them, but like the wider Protestant revolution seemingly immediately already moved on and was just doing.
Yeah, it just got sucked up into the whirlwind of things that were going. I mean, what we're really watching, maybe this is my what seems to be inherent lowercase r republicanism that I seem to just walk around with in my head. And so I'm like, you're watching a regime fall apart. It is in that cycle of its regime. That regime is the regime of the Catholic Church, and it is now fracturing into all of these other things. And there's really only so much you can do once you get to that point, right? Like these things then sort of fall into their own logic and become other things. So, yeah, I mean, this, okay, so we went deep into this. I thought that this was, again, I'm a little bit more familiar with the early English modern element of this. I did not grow up Protestant, so I do not have a lot of the prereqs to fully, I think, appreciate everything that's going on here or be theologically dialed in. But Gillespie points us to a big overview. And I just want to say that this chapter made me realize how important the theological antecedents to modernity are. I had read some stuff about why Luther is important for that, but this, I think, further justified that to me and helps me appreciate and believe in Gillespie's larger project here, whether or not he gets every single thing right. I mean, no one ever does. But in intention and direction, I think this is moving in a good way.
Yeah, I in a way that I can't say I always feel, I'm pretty like excited for the rest of the book because I don't exactly know what he's going to say about these people, and that's like pretty cool.
Yeah, that's nice. It's nice. It's refreshing. And also, it's nice to read something that encounters modernity and doesn't just assume the break with the theological world before. I think that there is a, I think that there's frankly too much of that. And I don't think it bears up to scrutiny. There
Yeah.
is, that is a sort of like Whiggish hagiography that I've never quite bought.
I find there to just be like a handful of memes in the like true sense that, however they came about, people just start passing them off as a conventional wisdom. And then once you realize that someone is saying this and they've never looked into it, like even a little bit, it just becomes so like distasteful, and I'm just like get so angry when I,
I mean, yeah, I have the other thing is like I can also see at what points in my life I also believed that just because it
Oh,
was
like totally,
ambient.
100%.
I think that that's really important here too. And I want to make this point generally about why we're doing this project is that I don't know if you experienced this, John. I want to end it on this actually. Is that I do think material conditions and stuff like that are super vital for understanding history. Right. I think the pure idealist conception of, ideas are this larger structure being the machine that moves history forward isn't completely correct. Obviously, I've dedicated a lot of my time to infrastructural achievements and how they have reformatted American thinking and living in my own work. But whenever I read a work like this or do my own like primary source historical investigations, as we will do soon enough, into this series that we're working on is that I realize that I believe things that I have no reference point for how I ever received what is literally a large scale historical narrative. Like, didn't come up in school to my recollection or whatever, but it is just in my brain somehow that I do appreciate the vitality of cultural history.
Yeah, I feel like for me, a huge point I would say in the last few years was realizing that I tended towards secondary source materials because they were often easier to read and provided a more ready-made thing for me to consume, in which, in the course of doing so, I could feel pretty smart and like come away with a lot more opinions about things. And I realized that I was doing that really almost to the exclusion of a lot of primary source investigation, even when the primary sources are available in English translation to me. And I don't know, it was maybe a confluence of things, but I started to see, like, while I was still doing history in undergrad as like a later coming student to university, like we were looking at papers and we had next to them like every source that they had, like we were scrutinizing it along with them. And I was like, yeah, like I just don't see how this guy read this way at all, except for the fact that he had an agenda and he was like literally just using that agenda. So then I was like, the kind of tyranny of secondary source material means that these agendas get furthered without any scrutiny for generations by people who are just like, well, I have to rely on this guy so that I don't have to worry about it. But like in so doing, you kind of lose the ability to even know what you're talking about anymore. It has been so abstracted. And I think that it's one of the reasons, like, kind of coming to this sort of idea a lot of times in my life, but never quite getting there. But I first thought about doing this project like years and years ago. I was reading like Nietzsche's lectures on the pre-Socratics, and I was reading some other people talking about, like, they had some very fundamental skepticisms about the foundations of modern physics philosophically. And they were like, if you looked into it, you'd realize how many unproven things are like the fundamental assumptions of this field of knowledge, and just different things that made me start to ask, like, how did this even come about? Like, what is the history of experimental science in the West? What relationship does it have to philosophy, to magic, to all these things?
To theology,
Yeah, and
like
like,
that's.
why, what are we doing, and how did we get there? Because I'm, it's something that not a lot of people look at or have a very good idea about. They're just kind of like doing whatever they're doing right now, and they don't care how they got here. And it became something that was a fundamental interest to me just because it felt like it's something we should understand, or I felt like kind of possessed of a desire to know about it. So I'm glad that we kind of ended up here with this, project to, like, we're gonna sit down and like read Bacon and Galileo and et al.
Yeah, I didn't start having these inclinations until I attended St. John's, where we did like Euclid and Galileo and like Lobachevsky and stuff like that. And you can actually see, And I remember being laughed at by this dude who went to Grinnell, who also studied philosophy, strictly analytic philosophy. And he said, "Yeah, it's funny that you guys actually do that because that was just our freshman intro course." And I was like, "You're way more confident about your access to truth than I am about mine, buddy. Let me just say that." A smart dude, by the way, that said that. Like, plenty of admiration for his intellect in all sorts of other ways. But as
Nippy
somebody who's been,
condescension.
yeah, but as somebody who's like, when you go back and actually read it, you are left with far more profound questions. So we're going to keep moving through this book. We have a book that John suggested is actually vital to do right after this. And that will end for a period of time our secondary sources. And we will move into the primary texts. And I might think about a way to integrate you guys, you listeners, into that a little bit more in terms of submitting questions or doing Q&As. I haven't quite thought that out yet. If any of you have bright ideas, feel free to reach out. Again, there are a lot of people with a lot of technical sophistication, and I have so much. I mean, I can see who's subscribed. I don't like obsessively hound you guys down, but I can tell by your email addresses that some of you are incredibly accomplished engineers and things like that. And in my life, teaching the classics to adults and continuing education studies and stuff like that, I have noticed that people who went to those fields where you crunch numbers or turn wrenches for a living or both, that there is a sense that you missed out on this. So what we're hoping to do is to provide you an access point into that so that you can investigate on your own, or perhaps you don't even have the time to do that, but you have a longing in your soul, basically, that has directed me to all sorts of places. And this is the place where it has directed you to think about these questions on your own time, because we believe that they're important to think about. So as ever, subscribe to the Substack so you can comment or, respond via email, whatever it is. That's the best way to reach me. I am the public face of this. Leave John alone. And we will see you next time. Very excited about this whole trip with you guys. Thank you for listening. We don't take it for granted. We're very lucky to be able to do this type of thinking publicly. So remember, stay sharp, stay strong, and stay radiant.